From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The House of Representatives on Thursday voted to raise the federal minimum wage from its current $7.25 an hour to $15 an hour, marking a significant victory for progressives and for labor rights. Only three House Republicans joined Democrats in voting for it. If the bill becomes law, it would mark the first federal minimum wage increase in over a decade and the largest jump ever. Even more importantly, the Raise the Wage bill ties future increases to the minimum wage to middle-class pay levels. Low-wage workers have for years been demanding an increase in their minimum wage to $15 an hour. And indeed, many cities and even states around the country have raised the floor of their wages. A recent report by the Congressional Budget Office estimated that nearly 30 million Americans would benefit from a federal increase to $15 an hour, and more than a million households would be lifted out of poverty. My guest is Negin Oliai. She is a researcher and editor at inequality.org. She previously worked as a journalist and digital producer at the Al Jazeera Media Network. Welcome to the program, Negin.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So let's talk first about what specifically is in this bill. As I said, progressives are considering it a huge victory. It comes, you know, after years of workers demanding $15 an hour, and it really is quite shocking and shameful how low our federal minimum wage is. So what is in the bill? As usual, I'm assuming that the increases to the wage are phased in over a few years?
That's right. So they'd be phased in over a period of a few years so that by 2024, the minimum wage would be $15 an hour for workers. Another aspect of the bill that should be getting a little bit more attention, and I'm so glad that you have me on to talk about it, is that the sub-minimum wage for several different workforces is also being eliminated through this. So that would also be gradually phased out. So for example, tip workers, their minimum wage at a federal level has been $2.13 since 1991. Yes, it's shameful. It's a poverty wage. And theoretically, you are supposed to expect employers to make up the difference between that and the current $7.25 wage, but enforcement's lax. That doesn't always happen. So that's also in there. That would also be gradually phased out, as would a specific kind of provision that has a sub-minimum wage for workers with disabilities. For example, people have heard stories of Goodwill paying workers just pennies on the dollar to do work in these kinds of sheltered workplaces, and also for youth workers as well. So one of the really important things that this bill does is ends these carve-outs that hurt all kinds of workers.
What about incarcerated workers?
It does not have that in there.
So for a number of these subgroups, such a bill, if it were to become law, would be pretty impressive. Why has it taken so long for the House to pass such a bill? And in fact, have there been earlier passages in one or other chambers of Congress over the past 10 years?
So this is the first time that we've seen this kind of like wide-ranging bill come through for the minimum wage. And as you mentioned in your introduction, the last increase was in 2009. And one thing I'd like to note is that, yes, the House has passed this, but we still need to go through the Senate, and we still
of
need
course.
To go through the presidency.
Right.
So it's quite important that this is just one step towards actual justice for low-wage workers.
But has it passed? Have earlier versions of this bill passed the House before?
Not this $15 one.
I see. So there have been other attempts to raise the wages to $10 an hour, to $12 an hour. Presumably those failed. Obviously those did fail to become law because we're still stuck at $7.25. What did it take to get the House to pass such a bill? You know, some people imply that I've seen some commentators say, well, since the Democrats are the opposition party, it behooves them to rally around such a bill and pass it. But if they were in control of more than one house of government, they might not be so enthusiastic.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely true. I think that something that's important to look at is that this is an opportunity for Democrats in the House to show what they could provide, you know. So in terms of looking towards 2020, that's something that people have said a lot, is that this shows kind of where the priorities for the Democratic Party will be if they do have the House and Senate and the presidency in 2020. So that's important. But, you know, more so than any kind of elected official, I think what it's taken to get here is organized workers, right? So you saw the first strike from the Fight for 15 in 2012. It's been 7 years. And that was when New York fast food workers walked off the job in 2012. And now, after 7 years, it's an international movement. And so that's really where this pressure is coming from. This is a great move on their part, but also it's been the organizing of workers and the demands of workers that have really centered this. It's been the demands of restaurant workers to be included in such a minimum wage bill as well.
And of course, those fights spanned many, many parts of the country after they first broke out in New York, as you mentioned, and they have had local successes. And of course, it should be noted that the demand for 15 an hour was made 7 years ago. One could even argue that today, or even by 2024, certainly, 15 an hour might not be sufficient.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, this is a one step towards justice to making sure that we can have a living wage for all workers, right? So it's not $15 an hour is a crucial demand because it is the one that's been raised up by the workers since 2012. But I 100% agree that one of the most interesting things about this bill that you mentioned in your introduction is that it does actually index the minimum wage to the typical worker's wage across the country. So it won't be stuck at the static rate. But yes, I mean, if you look at the MIT has a cost of living calculator, and the cost of living far exceeds the minimum wage, $7.25 or $15 an hour in many places. So it's important to make sure that we're constantly growing and building on these gains.
And that's a really critical part of this bill. Let's talk a little bit more about that indexing. So currently, it requires the federal minimum wage requires congressional action to raise it. And so, you know, workers around the country have to rely on Congress, you know, working in a non-dysfunctional manner, actually caring about workers. If this bill were to become law, you're saying that it's a dynamic figure, right? Is that true? And so presumably there would be a specific index that this would be tied to. And would it take into account the different costs of living in different parts of the country?
So the indexing takes into account, I want to address two things that you just pointed out there. So the indexing takes into account the typical worker's wage in the United States. But something that's important to realize is that it doesn't matter where you live in the country, we need a really robust floor. Another minimum wage bill that was put forth this year would have kind of put things based on a cost of living. And, you know, as we said, $15 an hour is a good base level wage, and we don't want to go any lower than that. So it is important to make sure that we have a national floor as well.
So I want to pick up on what you mentioned earlier about tipped workers. This is a really critical part of this bill. I mean, $2 and change is the current floor for tipped workers. They're supposed to be making up the extra in tips, but tipping is one of those things that relies on the goodwill of the people being served. And Reverend William Barber, who has been a strong proponent of economic justice issues around the country, wrote a very striking piece about the racist roots of tipping, which I don't think many Americans really know. Can you tell us a little bit of that history?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it is something that has completely kind of been erased when we talk about tip work. So a lot of the tip work kind of really became entrenched after the Civil War, when employers were looking for a way to not pay their workers, newly freed, black formerly enslaved people, a full wage. So what they did was they had tips. So what this does is it creates this kind of like permanent service class, right, where you have people who are expected to both be working for their employer, but then also working for a client and, you know, who changes day to day. You can have several of them within an hour. So what it means is that you have no expectation of a steady wage, first of all. It means that you also are bound to so many more people in terms of who you need to be pleasing in order to take home a reasonable salary. So when this happened after the Civil War, it became entrenched because one of the most notorious examples is the Pullman car porters. So the Pullman Railway Company hired these black porters to basically be serving mostly white clientele. When you think about tipping in that way, and you think about how we use it today, and you think about the restaurant industry, for example, where you have pervasive sexual harassment because women on the job are, have to be a little bit more compliant with their customers in order to get a tip, you can just see how disastrous this tipping policy has been to have a subminimum wage of $2.13 an hour.
It's pretty remarkable. And I just want to pick up another point from Reverend Barber's article. He quoted from a book that was written in 2009 that basically went through this history of tipping and how a particular journalist, I believe, in 1902, wrote that he was embarrassed to offer a tip to a white man. And this was the quote, and of course, remember this from 1902. So they use the term Negroes take tips. Of course, one expects that of them. It is a token of their inferiority, he wrote. Tips go with servility, and no man who is a voter in this country is in the least justified in being in service. It's remarkable how we have sort of culturally accepted tipping as the norm. But if you go outside the US, you know, to European nations, etc., there is a very different relationship to tipping, and you know, workers generally don't expect tips because they are paid a decent enough wage, and they also don't act as subservient to the people they are waiting on because they don't rely on that person's goodwill.
Absolutely, and something that's really interesting about that too, I would like to point out, is that yes, Europe, that's the practice of tipping is no longer so widespread, but that's actually where it came from.
Right.
And there was a really powerful movement that was pushing in the United States around the time in the post-Civil War era, around the time when that passage was first published, that was saying that, you know, this idea of tipping comes from aristocracy. So basically, American travelers would go to Europe, and this book that you've talked about, Carrie Seagrave's book, documents this, as well as Saru Jayaraman, who works for the who's the head of the Restaurant Opportunity Center, who has obviously done a lot of studies on tipping. And so they've looked at these like historical roots, and they found that they're coming from aristocracy. American travelers would go to Europe and they would want to be sophisticated. So they would come back and they would say like, oh, look, we tip. This is something that we have brought back from Europe. But in Europe, they were starting to realize this isn't a great practice. And in the United States, there were people who were pointing out that this is very controversial. This is no place in a democracy. You quoted the line about a voter, you know, standing shoulder to shoulder with other voters. You can't really expect one voter to be giving another voter a tip. And again, that's also very coded language when you think about voting too. This is really something it was kind of considered to be anti-democratic, a vestige of feudal Europe. And yet today we still have, again, $2.13 subminimum wage for tip workers.
So the bill, as it was passed by the House, has it been introduced into the Senate? For example, you know, has a champion of worker rights like Bernie Sanders introduced it into the Senate?
Yes, and something I'd like to say too is that, you know, there's already a lot of conversation about what will happen in the Senate. You know, we don't have the same kind of majority in the Senate that Democrats have in the House. But I want to point out that senators need to know that this is actually historic. This is a really popular bill, first of all. The minimum wage of $15 an hour is considered to be very popular. Polling has shown it to be popular with the majority of Americans. And also states like Missouri and Arkansas have both passed their own recent minimum wage increases.
Right, it's not just California.
Exactly. This is something that is, and neither of those two states are up to 15 yet, but you know, so these are states that have, you know, right there, four Republican senators, but at the same time, they're really pushing, you know, their voters are really pushing for higher minimum wages. So it's something to consider.
Has there been, I mean, what's the stage that it's at in the Senate yet? I mean, I imagine that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, simply because this is a bill supported by Democrats, might oppose it. Because unfortunately, that's what the Republican Party has been reduced to now, opposing anything and everything that's a Democratic idea.
And I think that's why it's just all the more important for us to lift up how popular this legislation is, and how basic it is, how fundamental of a right it is to demand a living wage, something that you can live off of if you're going to, you know, that's something that's a really basic right. And so, yes, I mean, of course, we have seen the history of this Republican Senate. We know what this bill is up against. But at the same time, they need to also know that workers are organized around this. Workers have been pushing for this, workers across the entire country. So these places where they might think they have a safe seat, they also need to know that workers want this. They need to be responding to their constituents. So I would just ask, if you're not responding to them, who are you responding to?
And is there a grassroots effort by, you know, even sort of, I don't know, conservative grassroots groups? I'm sort of, you know, feeling strange even stringing those words together, to push for $15 an hour. Is there any sort of, you know, bipartisan coalition, or is it mostly labor groups, workers groups, unions, and others?
Well, one thing I'd like to point out is, you know, when we think about the Fight for 15, who do we think about being considered the first target of that? And it's McDonald's, and they have ended their lobbying against the $15 minimum wage. They announced that earlier this year. So, I mean, even these corporations are coming around to the fact that this is popular and they're going to need to do it.
Wow.
I mean, there are plenty of conservative actors out there and industry and people in the industry who are trying to cast doubt on the widespread literature that shows how great increasing the minimum wage is for everyone. But at the same time, it's becoming so popular that some companies like McDonald's even know that they don't have the ability to oppose this anymore.
Now, opponents of the Raise the Wage Act, of course, are very excited about the Congressional Budget Office's report in early July, because although that CBO report showed that a $15 an hour federal minimum wage would boost 17 million workers, they're saying that it also shows that it would result in 1.3 million jobs being cut. And this, unfortunately, echoes what the standard conservative talking point is to raising wages ever, which is, oh, we'd all love to see people make more money, but it would mean that corporations would be forced to downsize and they would cut jobs.
Absolutely. I mean, that's something, again, I would like to echo what you said. It's a talking point. So the CBO report has come under criticism by some economists, most notably at EPI, the Economic Policy Institute, who have pointed out that, well, first of all, one thing that I'd like to lift up before all of this is that it also shows that 27 million workers would see benefits from this, right? And that's, again, a conservative estimate. There's estimates that say as high as 40 million workers would benefit, again, just from getting to this $15 an hour minimum wage. And it also shows that 1.3 million people will be lifted out of poverty. So there's a lot that's good in the CBO report. But one number that is getting a lot of attention is this determination that there would be some job losses. But the economists have pointed out that the way that they've created the study, it's not exactly the parameters that they're setting are a little bit more conservative in that frame. So they were calling for maybe more careful review of the available literature, most of which has found that there's actually minimal to no employment effects when it comes to raising the minimum wage.
And has there been models cities and states where after a few years of having $15 an hour, the impacts on the job market and the workforce were seen to be positive? I remember when the city of SeaTac in Washington, you know, which is where the Seattle area airport is located, it took perhaps the earliest action to raise its minimum wage to $15 an hour. And even though there was conservative opposition, it passed. And a few years later, the impacts to workers all across SeaTac was shown to be nothing but positive.
Yeah, I mean, one of those, speaking of that area, Seattle is one of the most widely cited areas on both sides of this. So there was a report that came out a couple years ago that was finding that it's kind of one of these things that the CBO report is kind of citing, saying that there have been negative impacts on job loss, but that's been shown not to be true for the most part. So basically the model that they're using, it's comparing Seattle to other places in Washington, which isn't really an appropriate comparison to make. So again, a lot of these kind of like deeper reports, there's a lot that's up for debate. But when you look at the practical effects of it, yeah, it's been pretty much exclusively positive.
I suppose one can imagine that corporations are attempting to cut their overhead and reduce costs all the time, no matter what. And if they could do with fewer workers, they would do with fewer workers, no matter what the minimum wage was, right? So if they're not cutting jobs with a floor of $7.25 an hour, if forced to increase to $15 an hour, they likely wouldn't cut jobs, unless, of course, they had to go out of business, which is something that Republicans do consistently try to threaten, this idea that corporations would go out of business, which would hurt workers. You know, but maybe the corporations could just start paying their CEOs and top executives a little bit less.
I'm so glad you said that, because, for example, the one that always gets brought up again is McDonald's. And their CEO in 2017 made $22 million. Wow. $22 million. So the idea that they can't afford to be paying a reasonable wage to the workers who are actually generating that profit is just absurd.
Disney Corporation CEO Bob Iger makes $66 million an hour. And Abigail Disney, the Disney heiress, recently visited the resort in Anaheim, California, and was shocked at the treatment of workers and has been calling Bob Iger out. I mean, $66 million a year. It's just unimaginable.
It truly is unimaginable. And that kind of gets me to another thing that the Fight for 15 has been advocating for. And it's 15 and a union. So that's
and a union. Part. Yes, that was and going to be one of my last questions. Let's talk about the okay. and a union part, which is so important.
Yes. Yeah, so that's part of the reason why we've gotten to this far in the first place at all has been because of worker organizing. And we need the union to make sure that the worker organizing can grow and build off of that so we can get to truly living wages for everyone. So that's something today workers at McDonald's are protesting still to demand a minimum wage that kicks in today, $15 an hour today. So forget, you know, when the Senate would pass this bill. But they want it. They're saying this is our time is now. And another thing that they're also saying is we want union organizing rights because they've shown and they've just proven that this is the thing that can get the most done is having workers come together to make the demands that they know that their companies can afford.
Right, because in their organizing around 15 an hour, workers have been acting as though they are in a union. Essentially, a union of workers is workers getting together to flex their collective bargaining rights. And so to formalize that as a union would be a wonderful next step, except, of course, we're living at a time where the current climate is so hostile to unions. The current administration is so hostile to unions. We've seen through their treatment of federal workers and federal worker unions how little they think of unions. So it's that union part of it is so critical because I suppose one can measure that the opposition to unions is indicative of just how important they are and just how effective they can be. Corporations are terrified of unions.
And that's another place where I'd like to point out, in terms of people, the people know that unions are working for them. Polling has shown that people know the power of a union. And so, again, it is these kinds of legislative steps that are keeping workers from getting the rights that they have, you know, and that's something that a few other bills are kind of trying to target is how do you get more worker power in the workplace. One of them, for example, the Workplace Democracy Act goes, you know, there's a few different kinds of ideas about how you can make it easier for workers to not have to go through like the NLRB election process and just have like the simple car check to be unionized. So there's all kinds of interesting ways of getting more worker power in the companies. And ultimately that's what this is about. Like this is making sure that workers have power in the economy. They're the ones who are powering it and they should have the power to change it to be fair for all of us.
So the Raise the Wage Act does not include any aspect of union rights. I suppose they're trying to keep it narrower it is pretty broad, though, considering all the different aspects we were talking about. So there are separate bills on that issue. Is it possible, Nagin, you think that in the Senate, even when this does get discussed, possibly voted on, that there will be senators attempting to strip away aspects of this bill? For example, strip away the subcategories of workers that would benefit?
I definitely think that's something that they will try to do. And the House has already been really proactive in making sure that it's clear that they will not settle for that. They do not want to take away any of these carve-outs. Something that I'd like to point out is that in 1938, when you had the first minimum wage law, it applied to about a fifth of the labor force. And that's something that this Raise the Wage Act is doing, is going to making sure that workers aren't going to be excluded. These exclusions tend to come from some kind of racist background, like with the tipped wage situation or the exclusions for agricultural workers or domestic workers. So making sure that these exclusions are not in there is a lot of the House Democrats have really signaled that's very important to them.
Hmm. Nagin, where can people find out more about the Raise the Wage Act? I'm assuming now is a very good time to start pressuring senators.
Absolutely. I mean, definitely people should be getting in touch with their senators, especially people who live in those states that have Republican senators. And you can go to our website, inequality.org, to find more. The Economic Policy Institute has been doing an excellent job of covering all of the different kinds of minimum wage provisions that are out there. So I'd encourage you to check out all of those.
That's inequality.org. Nagin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
My guest has been Nagin Oliai, researcher and editor at inequality.org. We've been discussing the House passage of the Raise the Wage Act. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and now on Spotify.